Keith Nobles is in studio with us. And Keith, you've got a couple, I mean, I think you've got a lot of stories. We're going to talk, first of all, about your uncle, Tim Cockrell, who was in World War II. But tell us a little bit about you, because I realized when we were connecting here that I had seen an article regarding the Taxpayer Bill of Rights from the Insurgent Tribe. So tell me about that.
Insurgent Tribe is a blog. Insurgent Tribe is a blog that Sean Mitchell and I have started. And it's politics, economics, culture, whatever of the day that we choose to write on. And we're pretty prolific. There's usually 3, 4, 5, 6 new posts up there every day.
That is a lot. That's a lot to sit down and do that.
Yeah, we get inspired sometimes.
Yeah, well, well, good deal. Well, we are really honored to have you here. I'm going to move this microphone just a little.
A little closer,
because everybody, we want to make sure everybody hears what you have to say. First of all, we connected talking about your uncle, Tim Cockrell, who he passed on in 1999, but he was in the Bataan Death March.
Yes.
But let's start at the beginning. Molly and I have learned, you know, I always knew of the Bataan Death March,
but
just recently did enough research on it to understand that this occurred shortly after the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
So,
May.
Let's start with that.
Well, so actually, I start a little bit before that. So he went in the Army, the end of the Depression, the late 1930s, and he was... felt very fortunate to get in the Army. During the Depression, it was very hard to get in the Army. He had clothes to wear, a place to sleep, 3 meals a day, and a paycheck. And there were quite a few young men in the United States in the Depression. Didn't have that. So it was difficult to get in. He felt fortunate. He was sent to the Philippines. He was in the 200th Coastal Artillery at Corregidor. And the day after Pearl Harbor, the Philippines were attacked by the Japanese.
I think a lot of people don't understand it. It was that quickly.
It was the day after.
Yeah.
And it went badly from the start. Douglas MacArthur made some critical strategic and tactical errors. And it fell apart quickly. And they withdrew to what was called the Bataan Peninsula. And they held out there until April 8th of 1942.
Okay.
MacArthur was ordered by Roosevelt to go to Australia. They did not want MacArthur to be captured. So my uncle Tim actually was the fellow who MacArthur was taken out on a PT boat from the docks at Corregidor. My uncle Tim is actually the fellow who lifted his son up and put MacArthur's son on the PT boat.
Wow.
And shortly after, General Wainwright was left in command.
And he stayed.
He stayed, and things continued to fall apart. The Bataan Peninsula fell in early April, and he surrendered in May 6th of 1942. And there were about 75,000 men that he surrendered. So it's the largest surrender in United States military history.
And we're talking with Keith Nobles. We're talking with him about his uncle. Is it Tom or Tim Cockrell?
Tim.
Okay. And the Japanese, we've come to learn when we talk to vets from World War II, the Pacific Theater was brutal. I mean, people kind of chose to go to the European Theater if they had a choice, because the Pacific Theater was really brutal. And the Japanese really looked upon people that surrendered as kind of almost below human beings.
Yes. And so back up a little bit again. Major reason that they had to surrender, that things went so poorly, many of their munitions were from World War I or even the Spanish-American War.
They weren't prepared.
They had rifle bullets that wouldn't fire. They had artillery shells that wouldn't explode, that sort of thing. And on top of that, by the time MacArthur left, they were almost all sick.
So malaria.
Yes, they were sick. If you could stay conscious, you were pretty much on the front line doing something. So when they surrendered, the death march, they had to march about 60 miles. They were given no food or water, and they were already sick. If you straggled, if you fell down, if you moved too slow for what the Japanese thought, there was a bad end to that. My uncle told me his lieutenant... So his lieutenant commanding him, the very first morning shortly after they started, he was very ill. He was straggling. A Japanese soldier came up, kicked him in the back, knocked him to the ground, drew a sword, and beheaded him.
Oof.
That was their introduction to being a POW for the Japanese. So there were 72,000 men that started out the march that morning, and there were only 54,000 who made it the 60 miles. So there were about 18,000 who died on the way. And then once they were at Camp O'Donnell, there were another 40% of that 54,000, about 20,000 more would pass away in the Japanese POW camp.
Keith, where did your uncle grow up?
Amarillo.
You know, and I've thought about this, Molly, as we have interviewed so many people about these different stories. These were young kids, from the Midwest or Texas. I mean, do you think they looked at this and they're like, this is unbelievable. This is so beyond my childhood.
Yeah, I think even after having fought the Japanese for several months, what happened to them on the death march was a shock. Nobody could. I mean, there was a racial component to this war, and that the Japanese felt they were a superior race. And
so did the Germans.
Yes.
Interesting.
And then, as you brought up, right, if you were, if you had surrendered, they considered that
subhuman.
Mm-hmm. And so, yes, they thought less of these men than you would think of a farm animal.
Wow.
Mm. And they were treated worse than animals were treated for the course of the war. Tim, when he was liberated in September.
And we're talking with Keith Nobles, and he's sharing stories about his uncle, Tim Cockerell, from World War II and the Bataan Death March.
Yeah, so when he was liberated in September of 45, he weighed 67 pounds, to give you an idea.
Oh, that's unbelievable.
Yeah. The Japanese knew that the United States was preparing to invade the Philippines. So in 1944, they started transferring prisoners to Japan. The POWs from the Philippines. So not all went. Some were left in the Philippines. He was one of those who was transferred to Japan. So he was at Nikita, Japan, when he was liberated.
You know, and Tim, we have learned that it was another cruel thing, and that the Japanese would transport some of these American prisoners of war on ships that actually
had the American Red Cross
on it. Yeah, had the American Red Cross on it, and then they were sunk.
Yeah, there was at least one ship carrying those Philippine POWs to Japan that was attacked by American forces and sunk.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it wasn't the one he was on, but there was, I know of at least one that was attacked and sunk.
But Keith, I can't even imagine that your uncle survived the entire Bataan Death March and then gets transferred to another prison camp.
Yeah, in Japan.
In Japan.
Yeah. Yeah, it's beyond terrible. I mean, the way they were treated, for example, on the ship being transferred from the Philippines to Japan, they crammed however many hundreds of these American POWs into the hold of the ship. And that's where they stayed the entire voyage. They didn't go up on deck or anything like that. But what they did was there was a single bucket that they used for human waste, and it was the same bucket the Japanese used to feed them.
Wow.
I mean, if you imagine just how horrific that is, and the effect on your health.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But that's why you weigh 67 pounds after 3.5 years of this.
Now tell me how you learned all these stories. Did your family get together?
We got together a lot.
And were you like a little kid just sitting there, just kind of taking all in? Or how did you learn these stories?
I learned these stories by being told them.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that was it, right? And I think we talked about before. I had seven uncles. Fought World War II. My aunts were really prolific at marrying these soldiers who came to Camp Gruber, Oklahoma, and they would meet them and they would marry them.
They couldn't resist a guy in a uniform.
That's
they?
Right. So I had these uncles who originated all over the country but married my aunts in Oklahoma.
Wow.
And so what happened was whenever these fellows were together, Christmas, Thanksgiving, whatever, when I was a kid, I mean, mostly what they talked about was World War II.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that was all these men from different parts of the country, from Massachusetts and Texas and different places. This was the thing they had in common.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They had all fought in World War II, some in Europe, some in the Pacific, some in the Navy, some in the Army. But, it was just the common thing they had.
Yeah. Was your uncle, Tim Cockerell, was he the only one that served as a POW? All of them.
Yes.
So there was probably a real reverence for him at these family get-togethers.
Yes. Yes. I had another uncle who was an MIA for a while.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, my uncle Buddy. His name is Alan Boland, and he dropped out of high school at age 17 in Fort Gibson, Oklahoma, and joined the Navy shortly after Pearl Harbor. And he was a scrawny little 17-year-old, and they made him a tail gunner on a Grumman Avengers.
Oh, my gosh.
A torpedo bomber in the Pacific. And he got shot down twice. He got machine gunned in the stomach on his 18th birthday. His carrier was sunk at one point, and he spent a couple of days floating around the Pacific in a little rubber raft. My grandmother got the MIA telegram.
Wow.
And when the war was over, he came out, decided he didn't really like it, rejoined the Navy, became a gunner on Catalinas, got sent to China. When Mao took over China, they burned all the Catalinas but one and flew out of China.
Now, what's a Catalina?
It's a flying boat.
Okay.
Yeah, big airplane, but it lands on the water.
Okay.
And immediately after that, he transferred to the Air Force, and he was in five more air crashes, and he stayed in until 72.
My goodness gracious.
Now, we're talking with Keith Nobles. It's World War II Day here on the Americhix Show. Your Uncle Buddy, did he tell you, floating around for 2 days until somebody found him after he was shot down, did he tell you about that time on the water and what he ate?
Did he see sharks?
Did he see sharks? What was it like?
It was rough. They caught a seagull. It was multiple. I don't know how many, but it was multiple men in this boat.
Okay.
It was their aircraft carrier had been sunk, and they floated around for, I don't know, 3 days, I think it was. But at one point, they caught a seagull, and they ate the seagull.
So, how do you catch a seagull?
I don't even want to kind of think about it.
Oh, they have a gun, but how do you get it?
No, it landed on the boat.
Oh.
Yeah, the seagull thought that was a good place to land. It landed on the boat. They caught the seagull. But other than that, yeah, for 3 days, they were...
No, that's not divine providence. I don't know what is.
So let's finish up with your uncle. After the war, what did he do? He came home 67 pounds. How long did it take for him to get healthy?
Well, and he later in his life, he would counsel the POWs who came back from Korea, and then he counseled the POWs who came back from Vietnam. So he would say, this is what I've heard him say, health would recover really quickly. You're almost euphoric, right? You've survived this. Uh-huh. Right, you're back home, you're with your family, you have good food, you have health care, right? You're sleeping in a real bed, you're safe, right? So your health recovers quickly, and then you kind of fall into the, they didn't call it that then, but now we would probably call it PTSD,
uh-huh.
Right? You'd have these issues with, you know, nightmares and depression and whatever else.
But, okay. We're talking with Keith Nobles regarding his uncle, Tim Cockrell, who was in World War II. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about that journey when he returned back to the United States after World War II. So we'll be right back with Tim Cockrell and his uncle, with Keith Nobles regarding his uncle, Tim Cockrell.
This is the Americhix, Molly and Kim, and it's Friday. It's World War II Day, so we're excited to be sharing World War II stories with you. And we have in studio with us Keith Nobles. Check him out at insurgenttribe.com. And he's telling us some stories about he has had seven uncles in World War II because every one of his aunts went out for one of those. Lou was looking for a good man in a uniform and got one, which is awesome. So he comes from a long line of heroes. And then also he's going to tell us a story next about his dad who served in the Korean War. But real quick, we were talking at break, Keith. You had mentioned your uncle, Tim Cockrell, while he was on the Bataan Death March, something very special happened because it's such a terribly long and brutal march, and they had no food, they had no water, it was hot, it was terrible, but he had something special happen.
As he was walking along, a Filipino lady snuck him two little sugar cubes. That was the only food he had for the 60-mile march, and it was an incredibly kind thing to do. I mean, she risked her life.
She risked her life.
Had the Japanese seen her, caught her doing that, they would have killed them both.
Yeah.
But she risked her life as he walked along to sneak him two little sugar cubes, and that's all he had to eat for these 60 miles.
Wow.
And as you said, when he got back after the war, he weighed 67 pounds.
Yeah.
That was huge.
Yeah. As we were going to break, Keith Nobles, you said that your uncle had a real heart for these guys coming back from Korea and from Vietnam.
Yeah.
And really helped out these guys that have been in POW camps. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, so he would go on and work for national cemeteries. He became superintendent of National Cemetery in Fort Gibson, Oklahoma, and then later he was the superintendent of National Cemetery in Nashville, Tennessee. But he also volunteered and worked with the POWs who came back from the Korean War and the POWs he came back from Vietnam, telling them what they could expect, how it was going to go. Like I said, it's kind of euphoric when you're free,
uh-huh.
right? And you have health care and you have food and your family and all these things, right? And then later on, you know, you start to have issues. So he helped prepare them for what to expect.
Yeah, these young kids had seen things that nobody really should have ever seen.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that it's something to work through that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had Greg Getch on with us regarding veterans listening to veterans. Mm. And he said that unless you've been through that, you really can't, and family can't understand it. And so it's really great. And when did he pass on then?
1999.
Okay. Any other stories you want to tell uncles or World War II before we move over to your dad?
You know, I had many uncles that fought World War II. I had an uncle who got hand grenaded in Germany, Fred Smith, toward the end of the war. I had another uncle, Ralph Conrad, fought through that. France and Germany fought at the Battle of the Bulge.
Wow.
One of my other uncles, Frank Conant, was a captain. He invaded the Philippines in October of 44.
And was that Marines then? Was that Marines that primarily did that kind of...
No, he was Army.
He was Army, okay.
And he was, in fact... He was on the Missouri when the Japanese signed the surrender. MacArthur invited him to go. So my Uncle Frank was on the Missouri for the Japanese surrender.
Okay. General Wainwright was the one that stayed in the Philippines, and he was captured, was on the Bataan Death March.
Right.
What'd your uncle think of him?
He thought the world of him. My uncle did not care too much for Douglas MacArthur.
And did he share why?
Yeah. He thought he made some terrible mistakes and left. No, it was not his fault he left. He was ordered to, but Wainwright was left with the task of surrendering and then being a POW with them in the camp. And my uncle thought the world of Wainwright. Okay.
We normally end the show with a quote, and so I searched out one because of General Wainwright, and I only found one, but it's a good one. So I'll be excited to share that at the end of the show. So, Molly, any other questions regarding World War II?
Real quick, you'd mentioned, was it Buddy or which was your uncle from World War II that you said had recently just passed from lung cancer in his 90s?
Oh, no, 99 he
99.
Died. Yeah, it was about 20 years ago.
99
years
old.
Yeah, he...
No, he wasn't in 99.
Oh, in 1999.
Yes. He was the uncle he was always your favorite uncle that your parents gritted their teeth. So I was 5 years old. He gave me a switchblade.
You only had one of those?
Oh, my gosh. At least it wasn't a drum set.
At least it wasn't one of those Pop-Tarts that somebody, like, you know, chewed into a shape of a gun. Well, yeah. That could really hurt you.
Every kindergartner needs a switchblade, right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't have made it out of kindergarten.
That kind of uncle.
I got it.
That's awesome. But you said that he had smoked all his life, and I thought it was so interesting, but he was a tail gunner in the war.
Yes, he in World War II, he was a tail gunner in Grumman Avengers, torpedo bombers. And, he smoked a lot. He said he earned every one of them.
I'm sure he did.
He drank a lot of beer.
And he probably said he earned every one of those, too, right?
Yes. Yeah, but he was shot down twice, had his carrier sunk, and was in five other aircraft crashes during from 42 to 72.
Wow.
So
he had a reason to live. Yeah. Well, and I was asking about the smoking because our friend Guy Whitten, mm-hmm. who's 101st Airborne, you know, who jumped in D-Day into St. Mary Glise, he said that all the parajumpers were smokers. And so at night, like they would, if everybody wanted to smoke, they had to close the door because they didn't want the Germans or anybody to see them coming. And so they were just smoking and smoking. But I was thinking, if your uncle was a tail gunner, he probably couldn't smoke back there because there's too much gas coming out.
Yeah, there was just, those planes were just too leaky.
Yeah.
And that's just the most dangerous place to be, too.
Yeah,
it's
pretty dangerous.
Man, they can see you coming. Okay. Definitely. Well, should we move to Korea War?
Let's do.
Okay.
So let's tell us a little bit about your father. We're talking with Keith Nobles and your father. What an interesting story. His name's Truman Nobles. So let's start with him.
Well, my father was riding pro rodeo in Oklahoma, and he was building a herd, buying cattle, and looking for land to buy and start a ranch. And next thing you know, he got drafted and went to Fort Leonard Wood for basic training. There were 130 guys in his basic training company, and 128 went to Korea. One guy went to Germany. My father went to Hokkaido. And in between Fort Leonard Wood and Hokkaido, he went to Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, and went to electronics school. So he showed up in Japan, Hokkaido, and fix radios and things like that for a couple of weeks.
Now, just a little more information. Your father was a Cherokee.
Yes.
From northeastern Oklahoma. And then Hokkaido is the northernmost island of Japan, right?
It's I think the Kuril Islands are north of there, but it's the northernmost large island.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, because I looked at a map because I wanted to ask you that question. Yes. Okay, so he's been sent to Hokkaido, Japan. What happens then?
Well, so he starts for a couple of weeks. He fixes radios, and then he gets these orders to report someplace the next morning. So he shows up. And my father was a large man. My father was like 6'4".
Kind of a big strapping guy.
He was a big guy, road pro rodeo, big tough guy, right? Yeah. Uh-huh. And he shows up, and there's like 200 of these other big tough guys there. And there's an officer comes in, puts them all in order, and tells them, "You're all now military police." And they give him an armband and a 1911 and an M1 carbine and a Jeep. that's the extent of his training.
That's all you need.
That's right. And the issue there wasn't GIs misbehaving. It was that there were Japanese Army veterans who were not happy with having lost the war, not happy with the occupation of Japan by the United States Army. And there was kind of this loose insurgency of causing harm to GIs and sabotaging things that the Army was doing on Hokkaido.
Now, explain to me, this is Japanese from veterans from the Japanese Army, right?
Yes, from World War II.
Okay.
So in the early 50s, yes, they're home. They're not happy they lost the war. They're not happy that the United States Army has occupied Japan.
You know, you can see that.
Yeah. And so he spent the next 50 weeks kind of chasing these guys around.
Wow.
So that's kind of what they did. There was
probably pretty dangerous.
Well, you know, not nearly as dangerous as Korea.
Yeah, right. But, okay.
You know, but yeah, you know, there were lots of there were things like at one point they were not allowed to eat any local food. It's just army rations only because of poisoning of GIs.
Wow.
You know, there were booby traps that were set and, you know, there were things like this. So They greatly enhanced the number of MPs on Hokkaido to try and find these guys.
Okay, so
when we come back, I'd like to know how they knew who to look for. You know, if they were wearing something specific, if there was, you know, what they said to look out for, what kind of behavior. I mean, how did they know exactly who they were looking for? This is the AmeriChicks. It's World War II Day, one of our favorites. And we are in studio right now with Keith Nobles, and he is sharing stories of his father who fought in Korea. Hey, welcome back to the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim, and happy Independence Day, long weekend on its way coming to you all. Because so many people are already starting already.
Yeah.
But Friday is our favorite because we get to talk about World War II veterans. And today we're adding on to that Korea as well. And because, as you know, when you celebrate Independence Day, you really just need to go out there and raise a glass of iced tea to a military service man or woman.
Stand on the shoulders
currently
of giants.
There or veteran, because they are the reason, their great sacrifices are the reason that we do still have independence here in America today and freedom today. Mm-hmm. And every day. So before we went to break, we're in studio with Keith Nobles, insurgenttribe.com. Check out his site. He's telling stories. He had seven uncles in the World War II, and then his father served during the Korean War, and he was telling us that story. So your father, Truman Nobles, he's in Hokkaido, which is the northernmost of Japan's main islands, during the Korean War, and he is military police. And tell us, you know, he was, you had some people that were Japanese that were upset after World War II and after the loss. And so while they wanted to do the right thing by Americans, there were some guys there that were not so happy and were coming after our guys. So how did we know who to protect ourselves from?
Mostly they found these guys or tried to find these guys with the cooperation of the local Japanese government. So the view of the Japanese government was not that their choices were will be not occupied or occupied by the United States. On Hokkaido, the view was we're either going to be occupied by the United States or we're going to be occupied by the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And they most certainly did not want to be occupied by the Soviet Union. So the local Japanese government was incentivized to help find these guys. Mm-hmm. From Hokkaido, they could literally watch Soviet MiGs take off mm-hmm. on the horizon. Mm-hmm. you know, they would occasionally get woke up in the middle of the night and sent down to the beach to dig trenches and sit in them with rifles because somebody thought the Soviets might invade.
Wow. You know, Keith, we're talking with Keith Nobles about his father who served in Korea. This morning I was at a breakfast and ended up chatting with somebody regarding World War II. And he had a friend who's since passed on who had some amazing stories regarding World War II. But he said that there was such a difference. He said that people wanted to be on the U.S. side. He said as the Soviets were coming in, that all the land that they took, you know, Poland and all that, they enslaved all those people. Whereas as the Americans came in, we liberated people. And so I'm sure the Japanese were very incentivized to work with the Americans here.
Yeah, there was a Japanese prime minister in the 60s who said the atom bomb was a worthwhile price to pay for not being occupied by the Soviet Union.
Yeah, they were cruel, very cruel.
It was, yeah, and you probably know, and I know people who came from the Soviet Union or from Eastern Bloc countries who have just horrifically bad stories.
Yeah, and most all of them have, that I know, have this deep appreciation for the American idea.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, I think about the terrible effect that the Soviet Union had on North Korea. I mean, look at them today. I mean, don't forget Otto Warmbier and what he went through in North Korea, because they still have their gulags and their labor camps that you know, really they learned from the Russians.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's terrible that that's still happening today.
Well,
but again,
it goes
Russia.
Well, the founders understood human nature. Yep. And when we hear about the story about this young guy, Otto Warmbier, that, you know, I think that many progressives like to try to think that we can evolve as human beings to treat each other nicely. But there's human nature.
Yes.
And human nature unchecked is not a good thing, which means as we go into the Independence Day celebrations here, this thing that our founders put together with this separation of powers and, you know, this Constitution, this vision of the Declaration, it is so unique, Keith,
yeah,
in this whole story of humankind. I know you have a great appreciation for that.
Yes. I mean, the proper role of government is to defend rights, not take them, right? That's what our system was set up to do, defend your rights, not transgress against them. It makes us unique in almost all the world.
It really does. Mm-hmm. It does. Well, let's go back to your father here, Korea. You know, so what happened? How long was he in there?
52 weeks in Korea, or in Japan.
52 weeks in Japan.
Yes.
So a year.
Yes.
Chasing around these kind of insurgents over there.
Yes.
And so when he came home, was he married to your mother then?
No.
Okay.
No, he came home. They sent him to Fort Carson. They discharged him. He flew home. He, rather than going back to riding rodeo, his brother had won a football scholarship to go to Northeastern State University, or then it was Northeastern State College in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, which originally was a Cherokee seminary. It's a very old school. And since his brother was going to college, he had the GI Bill. He thought, I'll go to college, right?
So okay.
He and his brother went off to college, and my dad became a teacher.
Really?
Yeah. What did he teach?
Mostly he taught sixth grade.
Oh my gosh! Would that not be fascinating for these little sixth graders and your father? Oh my goodness gracious!
Yeah, so he taught school till 1985 and retired and went off and became a landlord and did a bunch of other things. But
when did he pass on?
November last year.
Oh, okay, just recently. I bet you kind of miss him.
Yeah, it was 86.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, Keith Nobles, is there any other stories that you would like to share with regarding either your uncle Tim Cockrell, your father Truman Nobles, or any other of this myriad
family
of
members
uncles
that served?
Yeah.
Well, you know, like I said, when I was a kid growing up, right, there was kind of these men from different parts of the country, and this is what they had in common. They had all served. Right? It was the thing that tied them all together. And I think if you look back, you probably find that's probably true of World War I, the Civil War, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those men had a bond, even if they didn't meet until later in life, right?
Mm-hmm.
They had this shared experience of something that they did. So it was a common topic. And when I was a kid, like I said, my Uncle Buddy, he was still in. He was in until 72.
Mm-hmm.
We used to go visit him at Travis Air Force Base and
yeah. And how many children in your mother's family?
That's a good question. That's a trick question in my family.
Okay.
So there were six children.
Okay.
And then, but my mother grew up with many of her cousins that my grandmother raised.
Okay.
So there could be any number of children in that house at any given time.
And this was in Oklahoma, right?
This was in Oklahoma.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting, Keith Nobles, that your uncles and your dad, everybody still talked. They did talk about that kind of thing because, you know, as Kim and I have been interviewing as many World War II vets as possible over the past year, we found that many of their family members, you know, they'll come with and they'll listen or they're on the line listening and they're like, wow, I never knew that. They're hearing stories they never heard because they say that their fathers from World War II never shared those stories. They didn't talk about it unless, I guess it was to somebody who had that experience, but their kids didn't hear it.
Yeah, I think it was the fact that, so of all my uncles, one went in the Navy and went to San Diego and never went any farther. All of my other uncles saw combat.
That is astounding.
So, because, you know, POW, right? Two were wounded. But I think they all shared that, right? Mm-hmm. They all had that in common.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. What do you think that they would say today with what's going on in our world and our national security?
Can you
see any kind of advice on what to do?
Yeah. They would say straighten up.
Well, I do think that kind of taking the handcuffs off of our military, that has been a good thing. I as we go through these stories, you know, I realize all these guys are our sons and husbands and brothers. And when you realize just that connection, if we're not going to let our military do what they are supposed to do and what they're trained to do, then I really don't think that we should be putting them in harm's way.
Yeah, I'm very glad General Mattis is where he is.
Yeah, I think there's a real comfort in that for many of our military men and women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had an Uber driver last night that was very happy about that too as
really?
Well. He's a retired Marine, but he was in Iraq. And he told the terrible stories of serving underneath President Obama and the different things that they couldn't do. And they weren't allowed to, you know, have their guns on fire. They weren't allowed to go. They had to wear at night if they were running. They had to have those certain sparkles on, the reflectors on. So what? You're outside and the guy turns on a flashlight and here you are, just shoot me. I mean, it was just amazing that these guys couldn't even protect themselves in war over there. So. Really sad. So I'm glad that we have Mattis too. And one thing, just since we brought up Korea, I just wanted to give a shout out because my father, John Vogt, also served in Korea. He was a captain in the U.S. Air Force and he flew the A-bomb. He flew around North Africa and Europe scaring Russians. And, so.
He flew the A-bomb?
Yeah.
Now what is that exactly?
He had the atomic bomb in his plane.
Really?
Ready to drop it.
And I never knew that.
Yeah.
And they flew around.
Just flew around scaring them. Like, what? We're here. So.
Oh, my gosh.
Don't. Yes. Yeah,
I did not know that,
yeah.
Molly.
Yeah. Huh. Isn't that kind of fun?
Kind of interesting. My father, shortly before Korea was over, he enlisted because he didn't want to be drafted. And then the war stopped, and he was a mechanic on I think it was B-52s, I think. And so he spent 4 years doing that. But thank you to all of them.
Yes.
Really, really appreciate that.
Thank you to all of you out there, all of our veterans. We really appreciate it. When, you know, people say, you know, we just want to give back. That's the one group that we really never can give back to is our military men and women that sacrifice everything for us every day. So thank you to all of you.
Yep.
And at this 4th of July, if you all don't have anything going on or you're looking for something fun to do, Kim and I, the Americhicks, are going to be joining a great team down at the Capitol from 10 to 11. And it's a July for Trump event. So come on down and check out the website, julyfortrump.com. And they also have a Facebook as well. But you can bring your table, bring tents, bring balloons, what have you. It's going to be a good time. Mike McAlpine's putting this on. And Kim and I will be there and we'd love to meet you. So come on out and say hello.
Yeah, definitely. And we do wish everybody a great weekend, a great celebration for Independence Day. And I have changed something, Keith. Instead of saying Happy Fourth, I have moved over to saying Happy Independence Day because I think words matter. And that is really what we are celebrating, that this little ragtag group of guys decided to take on the greatest power in the world at that time. And they won. And they won because they had an ideal, this ideal that all men are created equal. And, you know, it took some time to get all that figured out, but that was what the premise of this whole country was founded on. And so I am now saying Happy Independence Day. So, Keith Nobles, it's been great to have you in studio with us. What would be the final thought that you'd like to leave with our listeners today?
Don't take any of this for granted.
Oh, that's for sure. That is for sure.
Freedom isn't free.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right. It's like Reagan said, it's always just one generation away.
Yeah.
We've got to keep shedding the light on the truth, too.
Yeah.
Make sure that people understand that. And that's why we're doing the World War II Project, so that future generations can listen to these videos, these audios, and always hear what our founding fathers did for them and what our military servicemen mm-hmm. and women go through.
Yes, we were talking earlier this week about Justice Clarence Thomas's ceremony where he spoke to the Hillsdale graduates. And he said that, you know, we really need to be careful to not squander what has been given to us. And like you say, Molly, that's one of the reasons why we are so passionate about doing this show. We want to educate people, inspire them to go out and be engaged. But I wanted to give you this quote from General Wainwright. He said, "Peace is a militant state which is not secured by wishful thinking. If we are to be sure of our liberty, we must be ready to fight for it." Thank you, General Wainwright. High school community.